We hear a lot about the sharing economy. You know, how companies like Uber, Airtasker, Airbnb have delivered more efficient and often cheaper alternatives to traditional services. But now there's a new movement afoot that's hoping to go one better by giving the providers of these services an actual stake in the company they work for. So in other words, Uber drivers would effectively own the Uber company in a co-op arrangement. Nathan Schneider is a journalist and professor from the University of Colorado Boulder. He's been probing these possibilities. Good afternoon, Nathan.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. So co-ops, could this happen? How does it work?
I think it's already happening. You know, over the course of the last couple of years, as this sharing economy has been emerging and so many people, I think with really good reasons, we're flocking to this idea of sharing more of the stuff that we rely on. There's been a kind of quieter movement that's really a kind of real sharing economy that practices sharing all the way down rather than kind of actually just renting stuff and calling it sharing. They're sharing ownership and governance within the companies themselves. And more, this approach to the sharing economy, especially as we see Uber drivers going on strike around the world and Airbnb creating big problems in cities all over the place, people are turning to this idea of genuine shared ownership and governance in the emerging online economy.
So are we talking about replacement companies to take on Uber and Airbnb, or are we talking about those companies restructuring their business model to give employees a stake?
I think we're talking about both, and we've already seen both start to develop. For instance, there's a startup in San Francisco called Lokonomics. That's a kind of alternative to TaskRabbit. So in that way, it's a bit more of a replacement. The workers co-own the company and set their own standards for the platform. At the same time, there are companies like Managed by Q, which is a kind of Uber-like on-demand office cleaning company that I believe started in New York. And they were using this Uber model and then started realizing they really need stronger commitment from the workers because the workers are the face of the company. So they've actually started moving toward giving workers ownership stake in the company as a business decision. And I think these conversions are increasingly necessary, especially when we see a company like Uber, Airbnb, or Google also, Facebook, really becoming less like regular businesses and more like public utilities. This approach of shared ownership is a way of dealing with that problem that I think is more appropriate to the 21st century online economy than the old antitrust model of breaking these companies up into little pieces.
But you've given a couple of examples there of people doing this already, but how likely is it that a lot of the really successful companies like Uber and Airbnb and Facebook will want to restructure knowing that will reduce their own profits?
Well, I think it could come in a lot of different ways. I mean, for one thing, this may just become necessary, and this may be a moment where we need government to step in. You know, when we have so much of our personal data and so much of really the common store of information in our society being held by particular companies, I think an arrangement needs to come where that information becomes truly democratized. At the same time, too, you know, there's a long history of quite large-scale cooperative enterprises when there's been a clear need for them. And I think we're in that moment now. You know, for instance, in the United States where I live, 75% of the landmass of the country gets its electricity from rural electric cooperatives that were established in many cases with government support in the 1920s and 30s. And these continue to serve millions and millions of people. And it's a reminder that when the need arises, it's very possible to build democratic enterprises at large scale and to meet needs that the capitalist markets alone are not meeting.
That's interesting because I think when a lot of us think about co-ops, we tend to think of things like co-op bookshops or community gardens or maybe even, I know in Britain they have supermarkets that are, especially in more regional areas, that are effectively co-ops of that local community. We don't tend to think of co-ops in a more corporate sense. But you're suggesting that unless we do this, then the wider economy might suffer?
That's right. You know, and listen, I lived in a co-op house once when I was in college, you know, and it was dirty and we played folk music every night. And, you know, we fulfilled that stereotype pretty nicely. But that is entirely different from what I saw, for instance, at the business school in outside of Nairobi, Kenya, for managers of cooperatives. And that's a country where 50% of the GDP flows through co-ops. And so they need really well-trained people. And those business students looked like business students anyway. You know, they were learning all the marketing and the case studies and the finance, except they were also learning how to run a business where the people who work for them are their bosses. They still have to practice good management. They still are able to work at scale and deal with large sums. And I think we've kind of, in many cases, had a kind of amnesia where we've forgotten that democracy is something we can do not just every few years at the ballot box, but it's actually something we should be able to do every day in the economy that we interact with, in the stores we go to, and in the workplaces that we devote so much of our energy toward.
How would it actually work? Let's take Uber as a case study. If Uber drivers suddenly were given a stake in that company, which I believe is presently owned by Google, what kind of stake are we talking about hypothetically? Is it just a small cut? It would be a small pie because there'd be millions of Uber drivers around the world.
It could be a matter of conversion of the existing company. But the interesting thing about Uber is that in a lot of ways it's a very thin operation. It's a chunk of software that gets replicated and used in all sorts of places. And a big part of the value is the fact that you can use that same software anywhere. So consider this. For instance, in Colorado where I live, as of last month, the largest taxi company is an 800-person immigrant-led worker cooperative, and these drivers are have an app associated with their company, and they own the whole operation locally, and they deal with local regulatory agencies. So there are a number of these local taxi cooperatives forming around the country kind of in response to the Uber moment. Now, what if they, rather than all relying on some centralized piece of software in a centralized organization, what if they shared an open source code base, you know, something like Wikipedia or Linux, the open source operating system? And they were all using the same tool, and they were all contributing to that tool and making it better. It would be a way of expanding laterally rather than just building a huge monopoly. And we see that with other platform cooperatives as well. For instance, Fairmundo is a German Amazon-like marketplace, and it's currently expanding into the UK. But rather than just making the company bigger, they're actually sharing open source software with another group in the UK that's starting to build in their own right. And rather than just growing, they're actually federating. So they're building a kind of umbrella organization that encompasses the two. So I think under a cooperative model, we might see different kinds of companies practicing different kinds of growth.
Yeah, no, it's sort of interesting to me because as someone who uses Uber, if we can go back to that case study again, as someone who uses it quite a bit, most of the drivers I talk to seem pretty happy. Seem pretty content. They've got flexible hours. They've got reasonable pay. Are you sensing something that I'm not? Are you sensing there's a growing discontent out there in some of these service-based startups?
Well, I think you're pointing to something really correct, which is that we are moving toward what I think of as a kind of platform economy, away from a model in which we go to the same job every day, and that's our whole life. And there are some really exciting things about that. You know, for a lot of my career, I've been a freelancer and really happy to be, because I could choose my own schedule and choose my own projects. And what I'm interested in really is creating a system where that actually works. And you see this a lot with, you know, Uber drivers and independent workers of all kinds. Things are great until something starts to go wrong. You know, you have a health crisis, you get into a car accident, and suddenly you've lost the support structure that was there with traditional employment. Some people have called this the precariat. It's this kind of situation that so many precarious workers are in, where they're losing what used to come with citizenship in a society, like health coverage and retirement coverage and insurance and these things that are so necessary. And the cooperative business model is a way of rebuilding that. And it's actually the same tool that was really used to develop the modern insurance industry, which began through mutual insurance companies that workers developed themselves. And so in some ways, this call to new cooperative solutions is kind of a throwback to what was going on in 100 years ago with the development of the industrial social safety net.
Right. On 702 ABC Sydney and 1233 ABC Newcastle, I'm chatting with Professor Nathan Schneider, who's a journalist and professor with the University of Colorado Boulder in the United States, talking about this move towards cooperatives and giving a stake to some of the people who work in the sharing economy at the moment, but who are only working in service to them at the moment, but don't necessarily have a capital advantage in working for these companies. I'd be interested to hear from anyone who does offer their service to a company, whether it's putting their home up on Airbnb or who drives for Uber or any of these other platforms. If you like the sound of this, if you are thinking, yeah, I'm working pretty hard, I think I deserve a slice of this pie, or whether you feel the status quo is okay, I'd love to hear your thoughts as someone who's actually on the ground doing the work on behalf of these sharing economy platforms. So give me a call. My number is 1-300-222-702, 1-300-222-702, or you can send me a text on 0467-922-702. How do startups work at the moment, Nathan? Like, I assume someone has an idea, normally in Silicon Valley, but not always, and and then they go to a venture capitalist to give them millions of dollars of investment to get it off the ground. Is that pretty much how most of these companies emerge?
Well, there's something else that gets handed over, and that's ownership in the company. When you get that money from that venture capitalist, and yes, it's usually in this kind of subculture of startup bros and in particular bubbles in the world where these founders and capitalists kind of accumulate. And in the process, there's this kind of deal with the devil that happens. Not that anybody involved is necessarily a devil, but there's something of that in the system, which is that in order to make your cool gizmo happen, to make it real, which is, you know, really, I think what most founders want, more than zillions and zillions of dollars, they want to do something, they want to contribute, is they have to hand over ownership of that company, a big chunk of it. And in some cases, they get to keep the company, like Mark Zuckerberg. You know, his investors have entrusted a lot in him. But in a lot of cases, they end up getting fired eventually by those investors who have a need for a tremendous return on the profit, so on the investment. So not only does the company have to be profitable and meet the needs of the people participating, it has to be enormously profitable in order to function within that system. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that actually some of the early interest in online co-ops that we started finding was among investors was because they're kind of looking for another business model, a way of building tech companies that is a little more reliable, a little less risky, and provides more stable returns. You know, co-op businesses in general fail much less than other kinds of businesses because they have a more durable investment from the participants. And so I think what we would see is a different kind of company, but in some ways maybe one that would ultimately be more satisfying both to participants and to founders. Like, imagine if you could create something really neat, build it, make it work, and then share it with a community of people who also love it, rather than just having to hand it over to a process that's designed solely to extract as much profit as possible. You know, I wonder if Mark Zuckerberg really loves the fact that his platform is allowing his investors to coax so much money out of his users' personal information on Facebook. Mm. What if instead, you know, the users had a say in deciding how that information was being used. After all, we're in effect, kind of workers on Facebook. We're contributing stuff to the company. You know, what if we had a say on what happens with that stuff? And we also had a stake in making sure the company also succeeded so we didn't run it into the ground.
So we almost kind of need a startup to take on the startups, like this new revolutionary movement online, which is bound to happen, is the way these things often do. And the thing that always interests me about these companies in this sort of Silicon Valley space, for want of using a better term, is that there's some very brilliant people who work in this area, and they're very good at tech, and they're very good at innovation. But I'm always interested in whether they're good at business, or whether you've got some really bright geeks who, you know, sometimes don't know that much about business, and that in a way might open opportunities to find alternative models like the co-op one you're suggesting.
Well, one of the things that's so wonderful about hacker culture, right, and the kind of culture out of which this stuff tends to emerge is that there's a lot of playfulness around systems. And one example of this is open source software, which I've mentioned before. You know, for decades now, we've benefited from what's really been a hack of copyright law, which is creating licenses like the GNU Public License and Creative Commons and using copyright law kind of against itself to create this free and open commons of code and information. And I think what we've overlooked in that process is the opportunity to hack corporate law, to hack the law that governs the owners and the profits of all of this cool stuff that we've been building in the online economy. And so in some ways, what we're calling for is a revolution in hacking that stuff.
Yeah.
What can companies look like so that they really share the benefits of what they create with the people who contribute to them? And that, I think, is a great hacker challenge, whether or not it's very different from what people think of as conventional business. But it's been fun to see a lot of people in hacker culture take on this challenge with a great deal of enthusiasm.
It's a beautiful idea. Simon, good afternoon.
G'day, gents. How are you?
Not too bad. Do you have a question for Nathan?
I do. Look, I was interested in the comments there about venture capitalists and the huge profits that they hope to see, which understandably is a result of the risk they're taking in investing in a new business. And I guess, you know, here on a small scale, we have things like that television program, The Shark Tank, where people get on and spout what they have in a business and the wealthy panelists decide whether to invest or not.
Yeah.
What I'm wondering from your guest is, do people in that capacity, venture capitalists, have a benchmark in their mind in terms of what sort of return they hope to receive? I mean, share market investors might be happy with 10 to 15%. What would a venture capitalist hope to get if he was going to throw $1 million at a new venture?
The scale is quite high. It's in the range of like 10 to 100 times return on investment. I mean, massive returns, but with a recognition that only a few of the companies are really going to work.
Right.
And so that enables this very high risk activity to take place. And in some cases, I think, you know, that risk is necessary, and you don't necessarily want to cooperativize that because, you know, if every startup were backed by a co-op, you'd have a lot of, small investors as members losing a lot of money. So it might actually make sense to have a kind of venture pool like that. But then as a company starts gaining steam, as it starts really serving a large number of people, you know, maybe there's a way to buy it out, to create certain kinds of funds that can reward, as you said, reward the risk that the investors took fairly, but also make sure that the alignment and the stakeholdership is right. And that's really what we're getting down to here is who are the true stakeholders of the businesses on which we rely, and how can we create better alignment, more democratic alignment between the enterprise and the true stakeholders.
Thanks for your call, Simon. And look, thank you, Nathan. It's been really fascinating. And if anyone's interested to hear Nathan Schneider in conversation, he will be in conversation with Frank Brennan in Sydney next Tuesday night. So thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much for having a foreigner on your show. Appreciate it.
Some foreigners are welcome in Australia, it turns out.